I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Karen Wells joins me now. She's just published a new book, Women Who Woke Up the Law, Inside the Cases That Changed Women's Rights in Canada. In the book, you read some gripping stories about women integral to advancing rights in the country. Irene Florence Murdoch, Chantal Dagla, Jeanette Corbier-Lavelle are just some of the women in the book who faced injustice and sought remedy through the legal system. And what did the women in the book seek? Abortion rights, the right for half of matrimonial assets, whether a woman was a person, maternity leave benefits, or among just a few of the landmark decisions kicked off by women in this book. Unfortunately for some, the cases don't go the way of those who initialized them. However, a lot of them end up cited in landmark decisions because the jurisprudence catches up. Karen, who joined me from Port Hope, Ontario, nearly 1 month ago, also focuses on the future. She looks at the requirement and enforcement of non-disclosure agreements and the protracted dispute between Jan Wong and her former employer, the Globe and Mail, which Jan writes about in her best-selling memoir, Out of the Blue, which she appeared on the program with in 2012, as well as the Nygaard situation, where thanks to NDAs he managed to insulate himself, for a while at least. I'll also get Karen to reflect on how we should not get so comfortable with rights we might have in our society, which are not always guaranteed and which could be taken away with a change of government like we're seeing in the United States. Karen Wells is a lawyer and well known for her work on CBC Radio. She's one of the finest documentarians in the history of the public broadcaster. Her previous books include The Abortion Caravan, When Women Shut Down the Government in the Battle for the Right to Choose, and More Than a Footnote, Canadian Women You Should Know. This new book, published by Second Story Press, is not just an important book. It makes for a terrific read because Karen's writing makes these stories come alive to great effect. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Karen Wells. Karen, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. As I was telling you before we started, there's just so many great stories in this book, and you tell them so wonderfully well, and you weave this narrative that you do. I was going to say chronologically. I'm not sure if it's exactly chronologically, but you don't just tell us about these cases, which is interesting enough, but you tell us about the people.
Well, that was the point.
Yeah.
Because the development of the law is all well chronicled, and it's of great interest, both personally and professionally, to lawyers. But sometimes it's kind of heavy slogging to the general public, as it were. The stuff that is the neat stuff is who were these people? You know, in this case, who were these women who either went to court or were taken to court, and what happened to them ended up seriously affecting the shape of law, the shape of the rights of women in this country. And they're interesting people, you know, these women are.
Well, what was the process like, Karen, for you to say, research all this? Because, I mean, it's a fun read. I'm wondering, was it a fun process to write?
Well, it was fun, but as I said, all the legal stuff is so well chronicled, you can dig it all up online. The stories of the women is tough to find, because often women who got themselves involved in very public court cases were not very pleased to have the spotlight shone upon them.
Mm.
And, I mean, the case of Chantal Daigle, she was a 20-year-old Quebec woman, a waitress who'd come down to Montreal from Chibougamau, which is 8 hours north. She was a small-town girl. And she got involved with this guy and became pregnant and very, very quickly realized he was not a good idea. He was violent, he was domineering, all of this. And this was the year after abortion was decriminalized. And she told him, I'm leaving you and I'm going to have an abortion. And she said in an affidavit, you know, I do not want to have a child in an atmosphere of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, her case went, what he did was he attempted to veto her her abortion, her application, arguing that the man is the father and has a right. And this had not been tested in court. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. She ultimately, quote, won and had the abortion. And Tremblay, Jean-Guy Tremblay, was vehement about this was his right to, you know, he was the father, he should be able to stop this, all of this. But what she did, and I am now getting to the point, was that following the Supreme Court case, this, what was she then, 21? Mm-hmm. She said, you know, thank you very much, court. And she went back to Shibugamu, and she changed her name, and she got married, and she didn't talk to the press again. So she hid herself, not really hid herself, simply declined to be part of the circus, if you like. So, if, you know, you get bits about these women in dribs and drabs. There's an Alberta farm wife named Irene Murdoch, and she established, although she lost in court, she established matrimonial property rights, that in a marriage, a couple has sort of a half interest in the assets accumulated in the course of that marriage. But after that court case was decided, and as I said, she lost, it was the hue and outcry that changed the law, she never spoke to the press again. So the only thing I could find little bits about her through interviews with her lawyer, and then her obituary, and she lived a long time, her obituary said she was born and raised the daughter of an Alberta ranger up in the Rocky Mountains, where she learned to ride, to rope, to shoot, all the things that, you know, the stereotypical Alberta woman, rural woman, knew. So, you know, that's, you've got these little bits here and there, but they were hard to find out about all these women.
Yeah, someone you tried to find was Stella Bliss. And in another case where she didn't get the outcome that she had hoped at the time that her case was before the courts. I mean, you know, you'd find articles written about her in the press, you know, and when you wanted to know more about her, there was very little defined, right? That was a maternity leave case, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned it. I mean, BC was the first place in Canada to introduce any form of maternity leave. It was unpaid, and that was back in 1921. Well, 50 years later, the federal government brought in paid maternity leave, and there were all sorts of conditions that surrounded it. And Stella Bliss, who was an immigrant to BC, was working. I mean, she needed the money. She was an everyday person who needed money to live on. She wasn't rich. And she, her benefits, she was disqualified, as it were, because, was it now, because she was pregnant when she started working. She didn't know she was pregnant. And then ultimately the conditions of the Federal Act of Parliament basically meant that a man could have got a maternity, not maternity leave, but employment insurance benefits around the time of the birth, like straight through. She could not. And so she started this campaign. And her case, I mean, again, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. She lost. But it was instrumental in redefining equality under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which was newly brought in. So, you know, there were all these people who were fascinated by the case, who had a really strong interest in it, but nobody could remember Stella Bliss. I had quite good contacts on the West Coast of women who were involved in similar things, political action. They could dimly remember her. you know, someone said she had long red hair. No, I think it was brown. And it kind of went on like that. One of her lawyers, a junior lawyer at the time, and most, if not all of these lawyers, not all, but most, acted either pro bono for nothing,
yep.
or they were legal aid lawyers. Now, this woman was, she became Madam Justice Lynn Smith, also became Dean of the UBC Law School, and she had a dim recollection. She had sat with Lynn Smith when the verdict of the Supreme Court came down, you know, and remembered that. And then, through complete luck, I found a photograph of her at the Vancouver City Archives. I mean, it just sort of came out of the blue. There was this photograph. And I forwarded it to Lynn Smith, and she said, yeah, that's her. And she didn't look anything the way anybody remembered her. She had also kind of, the case had worn her out, and she'd kind of disengaged before it was all over, although she continued to answer letters from women from all across the country. And she died about 8 years after the case. She died of brain cancer. But she... I mean, the Bliss case, as it's known, nobody knows much about the woman named Bliss, Stella Bliss, you know? So it's so interesting.
It is, because these are, you know, considered landmark cases.
Yep,
and we remember the names. And yet, like the Iwanchuk case in Alberta, that name is actually the perpetrator, not the name of the person that because the person there was Jane Doe in that case. You mentioned Stella Bliss dying. There was another case at the end of the book, and I forgot to write down the name. I think it's Bayless.
Hirschman. Oh, Bayless?
Yeah.
Yes.
She was being harassed by her boss. And she was trying to get him to stop, and he wouldn't. And then she finally takes up a complaint to the Human Rights Commission there in Ontario.
Yeah.
She prevails in the case. She's awarded a sum of money, but she never gets to collect because he was a psychiatrist, I think, or something like that.
He was a physiotherapist.
Oh, physiotherapist. So he skips the country, and unfortunately, she died not long after her case, right?
Yes, she was, and it's essential to mention she was a black woman, and that case involved a very modern concept called intersectionality, where somebody is being discriminated against for more than one prohibited grounds. In this case, she was discriminated against because she was a woman, because of this sexual harassment in her workplace. And also, she was discriminated against because she, on the grounds of race, she was a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And the judgment says she wasn't only a black person. She wasn't only a woman. She was a black woman. And to the guy, the physiotherapist, that was his target. He had a fixation about these sort of sexual proclivities of black women. And this was, you know, one of the first cases that recognized that putting those two things together creates something else again.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure, you know, she died of Crohn's disease, and I'm sure that has, you know, genetic origins. But you bet, dragging herself through this case and the stress that involved would have compounded problems. Yeah, there you go.
We hear a lot, Karen, about barriers to legal access in this country, to courts especially, backlogs and the sort. The thing that struck me as I was reading your book is that these are all women who, I guess, didn't have the resources to do this, but managed to get to the Supreme Court with their cases.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long slog to get to the Supreme Court. You know, because you have to go through various appeals at lower courts, but you know, in spite of all these barriers, they make it through, and these cases come to the fore because of women, and you know, as we said a moment ago, not all the cases are won, but they certainly set forth a path to victory in the future, don't they? Or some significant change in the future, I should say.
Yeah, because like the case of Irene Murdoch in Alberta, the ranch wife, when her marriage ended badly, with great violence, she dug in her heels and wanted a piece of the ranch. Now, you know, this what ended being the redefinition of matrimonial property rights did go all the way up to the Supreme Court. And it was just her digging in her heels, you know, that that was what did it. And then Madam Justice Bertha Wilson, who was the first woman appointed to the Supreme Court, said, you know, that the law and society act in tandem. The law can't radically change things. And it's an evolution, usually, less than a revolution, although some things seem quite radical. And these things have to come together. In the case of Irene Murdoch, you know, there was this huge outcry. It was in the 70s from different aspects of the women's movement. You know, the urbanites, the very political young women who had the bit between their teeth, and a couple, for instance, of quite conservative Alberta women's groups, one farm wives, who didn't necessarily agree with things like abortion or even drinking. They you know, were descendants of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. But they were all wedded to the land. They all believed in their connection and their right to a piece of that land, their ranch. And so you've got this coming together, and you've got this shift in society that ultimately was reflected in the law after Irene Murdoch, you know, put herself on the line and lost.
Yeah. I learned a lot in the book about the Persons case. I mean, you know, growing up in this country, we saw that minute and a half or 2 minutes or whatever that was on the television, the Heritage Minute. And then, of course, in recent years, her legacy has been called into question. How do you, say, reflect on Emily Murphy's complicated legacy?
It is complicated. She was, and this is, you know, the title she bears, the first woman judge in the British Empire. And I think that happened in large part because she arrived in Alberta right at the beginning, when Alberta was just a province, and the province was kind of making it up as it went along, and appointed her to the bench. She had no legal training, didn't really think it was necessary, and on she went. And she was a strong-minded, determined woman. And, you know, she got together with four other women, most notably Nellie McClung. Her name is probably the best known.
Yeah.
But the legacy is complicated because, and this I found interesting, if you go right back to her childhood, her grandfather was a man named Ogle Gowan, and he brought, and we hardly give this a moment's thought today, but what's called the Orange Order into Canada from Ireland. And that was a movement, and I believe it's pretty well certain that no club or group or movement has ever had more members in it in this country than the Orange Order. And they were vehemently Protestant. In Ireland, her grandfather's used to chase and murder Catholics. Because Catholics were, I mean, you know, we talk about discrimination against Indigenous people today. You know, go back and there was, I mean, Catholics were stoned, were shot, were killed, certainly in Ontario. And that was Emily Murphy's background. So she grew up as defender of the white Protestant race, as it were. And that's where she came from. So if you take that and, you know, apply it to a judge who's not tutored or schooled, it's not surprising that you find what we certainly today would consider a pretty racist person. You know, she had no time for indigenous people. She had no time for Chinese people. She associated with the Chinese in Alberta as bringing in drugs. That was how she labeled them.
Yeah.
So she's a dubious feminist icon. You know, she's difficult to come to terms with. You know, we have a harder time sort of heralding Emily Murphy today than a number of years ago. Yet at the same time, she was instrumental in bringing the person's case, the case that allowed women to hold office, that said women were indeed people, which with the argument was that women really weren't, and therefore a woman couldn't be a senator, etc. So she's tricky.
Yeah.
Emily Murphy's a tricky bundle of stuff.
It's a fascinating chapter, though, because you do chronicle the person's case as it moves up. And in those days, the highest court there wasn't a Supreme Court in this country. You had to go to England.
There was a Supreme Court, but
it was not the last
court.
What
was above them was the British court, because we weren't fully independent, you know, at that time in the early 30s.
The end of the book talks about non-disclosure agreements and their application and how reforms are needed. You talk about Jan Wong's case against the Globe and Mail. The Nygaard case showed us just how he insulated himself thanks to NDAs. What do you think the future is for those and their use in the society and the culture itself? Because, I mean, there is great reform that's needed, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's also a difficult one. I mean, I worked for the CBC for a number of years, and after I left the CBC, I went back to law school, and I did a master's degree in dispute resolution, alternative dispute resolution, which is all about settlement and talking it through and moving away from the adversarial system. And, I mean, something like 97% of cases never go to court anymore. They are settled. And an almost inevitable condition of settlement is a non-disclosure agreement. Now, I mean, lawyers will tell you without non-disclosure agreements, which means you can't talk about it. You can't talk about how much you were paid.
Mm-hmm.
You can't talk about what you were alleging, whether it be prohibited discrimination, racial, a sexual assault, and the one perhaps that we're most familiar with is the Hockey Canada case, where a young woman brought the complaint forward that she had been sexually assaulted by a junior hockey team, and was, to use the phrase, paid off. But she can't talk about it. That's the deal. So the question is that right? Does that privatize the law? I mean, you know, one of our maxims is that justice must not only be done, but must be seen to be done. We need, you know, that publicly we need to all know what's going on. I mean, we need only to know where we stand with the law to be able to cite precedent, and that becomes difficult. Now, if there is approved criminal act, then, you know, you can't settle that. You can't make that go away. But it's all this stuff in between with anything involving sexual assault, etc. So at the moment, Prince Edward Island has passed legislation prohibiting non-disclosure agreements in areas of misconduct. Just to go back two steps, they started coming out of the high-tech industry. Dear me, what's the word? The area just outside San Francisco where all the high-tech stuff comes from.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
Silicon
Valley.
Silicon Valley. Yeah. Thank you. My mind went blank. They came out of that to stop people giving away trade secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you'll get this hunk of money by way of severance, but you can't talk about how we do stuff here.
Yeah.
Fine, that's trade, that's commerce, that's acceptable. But when you start expanding it to dubious areas, like discriminatory areas, assault, that's not so palatable.
Yeah.
Canadian Bar Association passed a strong vote, high majority vote, saying they should be prohibited in areas of misconduct. But as I said, only Prince Edward Island has passed legislation, and in Ontario, there's legislation prohibiting their use in the context of universities. If it were a student and perhaps a professor or a senior member of staff, something like that,
yeah.
You can't use a non-disclosure agreement. But, I mean, Manitoba, just in the previous, under the previous Conservative government, considered non-disclosure agreements and ultimately ruled, no, we will keep them in.
Yeah.
And they received a letter from someone who'd gone through terrible stuff. I think it was involving childhood sexual abuse, that basically said non-disclosure agreements are dreadful, but without them, it would be even worse. I mean, and that the non-disclosure agreement even means you can't discuss this with a therapist.
Yeah.
Or a religious member, a clergyman, anything like that. So
yeah.
they're difficult.
And again, it's the book talks just about what's needed to do in the future. And the thing that I got about your book, Karen, that I keep thinking about it long after I finished it, is that you mentioned the Dagla case, you know, abortion.
Yeah.
The access to abortion, I should say. I mean, you know, that's something that's still talked about today. I mean, sure, we have access today, but these things aren't settled, are they? We just need to look at what's happening in the United States to see that, you know, very quickly something granted by a court can be taken away.
Yeah.
And we should never get comfortable about the rights we have because, you know, they aren't guaranteed and we need to fight for them, as these women have done for on a lot of issues, as you write in the book.
Yeah. I mean, don't take your eye off the ball,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also don't feel too smug that it's only those dreadful Americans that do things like this, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's, you got to keep at it.
Yeah.
It was, you know, not small, but aspects coming out of the pandemic where all of a sudden women's unemployment and pay was more seriously affected than men.
Mm.
You know, that's economic and difficult, you know. So, but if there is not more regulation in employment situations, women will get the wrong and short end of the stick as well.
Are you working on another book now?
Not right now. I'm musing because I want to do another one.
Yeah.
I haven't quite decided which way to jump. You know.
Well,
part of me would like to do fiction, but I don't know. I don't think that'll happen.
You made me want to go back to your previous books, The Abortion Caravan and More Than a Footnote. This book is wonderfully written, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time today because it's such an important book, and one that I think we need to reflect upon, especially now and always. I appreciate your time again. Congratulations and continued good luck with the book, Karen.
Thank you very much, Joseph. I really appreciate this.
The book is called Women Who Woke Up the Law, Inside the Cases That Changed Women's Rights in Canada. It's published by Second Story Press. Its author, Karen Wells, joined me on the line from Port Hope, Ontario. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.